niggas on the left, rag shit to death. Hoods on the right, wild for the night. Punks in the back, come on in the track to what? Land in the front, let your feet stomp. Niggas on the left, rag shit to death. Hoods on the right, wild for the night. Punks in the back, come on in the track to what?
Comes back to 19.
Hey guys, welcome to another episode of the Cracked Podcast. In case you are not familiar with Cracked, we are the humor website that grew out of the dead body of Cracked Magazine, which you may remember as the GoBots to Mad Magazine's Transformers. That version of Cracked died in the 2001 terror attacks, actually. True story. The editorial offices were housed in the buildings in Florida that got shut down because of the anthrax attacks. And I was hired to help relaunch that brand for America, you guys. And I failed. We are nothing like that magazine. No booger jokes, very few comics. Instead, we created a new brand that's more of a spy magazine meets old National Lampoon meets National Geographic with dick jokes, is how one of our writers put it. We update every day with 5 to 7 new pieces of content guaranteed to make you laugh until you have slightly less air in your lungs. And we also aim to kind of give you true nonfiction information that makes the world around you kind of seem more interesting than it looked before you came to our site. You're inside one of those pieces of content right now. Welcome. Today's episode is a conversation between myself and three of our full-time writer producers about the endings of popular stories, TV shows, movies, novels. We're going to be talking about the endings that they were supposed to have. I have this weird theory that there are endings that stories are like meant to have in the way that soulmates are meant for each other. So like not in my opinion, but in an objective way. Once a story gets to the halfway point, there exists an objectively correct ending that the author or creator needs to find or will fail to find, and everyone will be disappointed. That's why when you see a great ending, it feels like it was predestined all along from the beginning of the story. This is the way it had to end. To buy this theory, you have to believe that artists sometimes don't totally have control over what they're creating or like access to the part of their brain that is creating it. So here's a quote I found in preparation for this episode from the great director, M. Night Shyamalan, about the process of writing The Sixth Sense, one of the most famous movie endings of all time. He said, "It wasn't until about the fifth draft that I really began to figure it out. It was then that I realized that at the end, he realizes he's dead. It took me 5 more drafts to execute it right." So he spent months of his life writing and rewriting the screenplay for The Sixth Sense before he knew the ending that made The Sixth Sense worth writing in the first place. So my theory is that a part of his brain had already figured out that this screenplay had this amazing twist, and it was just a matter of him writing enough drafts to find it. And I base that theory on the fact that most of his subsequent scripts are clearly first drafts, but on that first one, he knew damn well there was something out there that just totally worked. There was like this sweet spot that he had to hit. And then, you know, with movies like Signs and Lady in the Water, he just fired off a first draft and was like, yeah, that's the Shyamalan goods. Anyways, I think the internet is actually great at finding these best possible endings, which sounds ridiculous, right? The internet is lousy with just terrible alternate endings where Harrison Ford and Tommy Lee Jones have sex with the entire cast of Star Trek Deep Space Nine at the end of The Fugitive for 30 minutes. Those aren't the endings that we're going to be talking about. We cut the solid hour about Deep Space Nine slash fiction from the podcast. But the internet is good at generating terrible endings, but it's also good at finding the correct endings because it's just this amazing, massive guess and check machine, right? It generates all this different fan fiction, and eventually one person hits on just a great idea. You saw this during the last 6 weeks of Breaking Bad, when I think more time was spent writing different endings to Breaking Bad on the internet than was spent in Hollywood writing actual scripts for anything. So I started the podcast talking about this idea in the context of Twilight for some reason, because I know my audience, I guess. You guys like Twilight, right? So let's join that conversation. This is my conversation with Daniel O'Brien, Adam Ganzer, and Brendan Carter. Actually, before we start, a few spoilers. I spend just an unreasonable amount of time at the start of the conversation talking about the ending of Twilight. So if you're trying to avoid Twilight spoilers, look out for minutes 8 to 13. There be spoilers. Dexter fans who haven't watched the last season yet, don't. If you insist, we spoil the ending of that from about the 13th to the 23rd minute. And in the last 2 minutes of the Dexter part, 20th to 23rd, I'd say, we briefly touch on the end of Breaking Bad. Nothing too concrete, but you're the internet, so I'm being careful. All right, bring back the woo.
Bring that fucking mess in here, man.
Yo. We gonna drink some of these nights.
Champion gear that I rock, you get your boots knocked, then attack you like a pit, then lock shit down. As damn. I come and freaks the sound, hardcore, but giving you more and more, like ding, not sure to get you open like six packs. Killer bees exact, flipping what, murder one fat tracks, alright? I kick it like a night flight, work light, I get that ass raw, going spike. Check the method from bedrock, cause I rock your head to bed, just like rocking what, twin clocks. Shake the ground while my beats just break it down.
Welcome to another episode of the Cracked Podcast, in which we are going to be talking about better endings for TV shows, movies, books. Yeah, books, Dan, that's right. I'm taking it there. Right now we have Daniel O'Brien with us, head writer, guy who told you about Lyndon Johnson's giant wang last week.
The guy who won't stop telling you about it, in fact.
Adam Ganser, a.k.a. The Gans, he told you about the origin of the summer break at a certain point if you've listened to every single episode.
Woo!
He communicates only in monosyllabic grunts and noises. And Brendan Carter, who you've heard from briefly talking about Caligula, I believe.
Mm-hmm.
Because I hijacked his only interview. And I'm going to cut him off again there. I want to explain why we're talking about the endings of TV shows, because this seems like it could be a somewhat obnoxious subject for a podcast, right? We're going to come up with better endings than the professionals who come up with them. And so to explain why that isn't obnoxious, I wanted to talk about Twilight, which is a series of novels that I have never read, but we wrote about them at a certain point in an article called, I believe it was like Fan Theories That Are Better Than the Movie Themselves or something.
Jack doesn't care for the site.
I don't care. Yeah, whatever. The five most fan theories or whatever. So here's what got me with the Twilight universe and why I think Twilight made this podcast necessary. So heading into the second half of the Twilight series, there are certain rules that Stephanie Meyer has set up. One is that Edward is a vampire who can read all human minds. He's a mind-reading vampire. Two, he can't read Bella's mind for some reason. That's the love interest. Edward is the handsome vampire. And vampires and werewolves hate each other. I don't think she came up with that. That's just the truth.
Probably Underworld came up with that. Yeah.
And then the final thing is that vampires are not able to get a human pregnant.
I want you to describe all books to me from now on.
So these are the Twilight rules, Dan. Come on. At a certain point, Edward gets Bella pregnant, which should technically be impossible, right? Based on the rules that we just set out, that Stephanie Meyer had set out. So heading into like the end of the Twilight saga, there were all these questions. Like, first of all, still, why couldn't Edward read Bella's thoughts? Why couldn't he read the thoughts of the baby that Bella was going to have? Because he should be able to, because it was like part human. And the fans of Twilight came up with a fan theory that was basically Bella is twist Teen Wolf. You know, she's going to have this scene where she discovers, oh, shit. That's also, I think this is how you can save any saga. I think The Godfather should have had that twist as well. Just twist Michael Corleone as a Teen Wolf. And it makes sense because in the second book, the guy who's looks awesome without a shirt on just suddenly becomes a werewolf. He didn't know he was a werewolf, but that's a thing that can happen. It would have explained why Edward couldn't read her mind. It would explain why this baby is special and why they're able to have a baby. And it would have turned Twilight into Star Wars.
because they're like bringing balance to this ancient feud between vampires and werewolves. So none of that shit ended up happening. That was just a fan theory. Stephanie Meyer's explanation was that the baby had something wrapped around it in her stomach and that he couldn't read her mind because she was so beautiful.
Bullshit.
Yeah. So the fans came up with a perfect ending ahead of the final two novels, and she just was like, no, it's like she's super pretty and he's like can't like think straight when he's around her. It was like the shittiest ending. By the way, it should be noted that Stephanie Meyer didn't know she was a writer when she started writing the Twilight novels. I know a lot about the Twilight.
Is that true?
Yeah, I think she like started writing it and then was like, wow, I'm pretty
what am I doing
this
with my hands? Yeah. Oh no, a book.
So my theory is that some part of her mind knew that that should be the ending, some part of her mind that she didn't have access to. But artists do their best work when it's just like coming out of them, when they feel like they're like the vessel for the work. It's not them doing it. Cormac McCarthy said that The Road was just dictated to him over a weekend.
I told him.
You were dictating it to him, I know. It was a sick prank that we played on Cormac McCarthy. But there's this sense in which the best art comes when the artist has no ownership and doesn't have to feel any responsibility. And when you have these long sagas that are bestsellers by the time you get to the third book, or any, you know, long series of films or novels, the more buildup there is, the more people are going to make that person feel like they own whatever's coming next. That's not what good art comes from. Good art comes from anonymity, which is why I think the internet is better at coming up with endings for these things sometimes. So that's sort of the context. We shouldn't blame these writers for not having come up with better endings because the deck is stacked against them. It's almost impossible for them to come up with a good ending because all they're doing is being interviewed by people to be like, you're the showrunner. This is your like genius. How are you going to end this? And they're making the decision in a way that isn't conducive to like good art or cool stuff happening or like ending the vampire werewolf feud. Stephanie Meyer. So we're going to start with Dan, who's going to tell us the way that Dexter should have ended. I guess Dexter ended recently, right?
Dexter just ended, yeah. And for people who haven't seen the last season, this contains spoilers, the first of which being it was shitty. It was a very bad season.
Famously so, right?
Yeah, like, yeah, really, really bad. So Dexter's a serial killer, and he kills people who are also serial killers. He only kills bad people. That's what the show is about. And the end of this show, the whole last season, he kills a whole bunch more serial killers, except one, and that one ends up murdering his... I'm seriously going to do a lot of spoilers right now. Ends up murdering his sister, Deb, and then he takes Deb out of the hospital where she dies and throws her into the ocean, where he throws all the people that he murders, then takes his boat, and he drives it straight into a hurricane, and everyone's like, oh my god, Dexter's dead. Meanwhile, he sent his son to live with this woman, Hannah, who was also a serial killer, and then everyone's like, oh no, Dexter's dead, and Deb's dead, and neither of their bodies exist anywhere, and that's not weird to us, and that's fine. Credits. And then, oh no, suddenly Dexter's alive. He goes to live in the mountains, he grows a beard, and he's a lumberjack living in the mountains.
Like Wolverine?
Like Wolverine, but he's just like, I'm Dexter and I'm not allowed to be happy, so I'm going to live in the mountains where I'm presumably not murdering people. And meanwhile, he let his...
He's murdering trees.
Like, he's a deadbeat dad now, too. Like, he gave up his son and not...
To a
serial killer.
Not famous for their child care.
No, no. Ability. To a serial killer that he has not known for more than a year. And he was like, hey, Hannah, meet me in Argentina. Here, take my son.
Psych,
yeah, I'm dead forever now. That's how Dexter ended.
That's a bad way to fake your own death, isn't it?
It's a really bad way to
drive a boat into a hurricane. Who sees that? Other than the people watching the series finale.
Nobody sees it. Just me, who has invested 8 years into this show, and then I have to watch it.
You sound mad.
I'm real mad.
Like there's a simmering, simmering anger.
Well, it's because what I want in an ending for a show or a book or a movie is something that pays off. I'm not big into twist or like, oh, I was very surprised by that ending. It did the thing that I didn't expect. I really like symmetry and I like story structure that pays off very well. So you start this show, Dexter, and it's about a guy who was a serial killer while working for the police. and there's a tension there. So you think right from the beginning, it needs to be resolved. Either he dies or he gets arrested because he can't go on serial killing for the rest of his life, because then why the hell are we doing this show? The show did such a good job throughout to lead towards something, because Deb has a wife and then his wife dies and he's got this son that needs to be raised by someone who isn't a serial killer. That's all I want for his kid. And then meanwhile, you've got Dexter's sister, Deb, who every guy that she's gotten close to has either turned out to be a serial killer or has been murdered. So you know, okay, Dexter shouldn't raise this kid. Deb should raise a kid, but will never be able to get married because she's just, every guy that she's attached herself to has been a train wreck. You're setting this up really well. Deb should raise Dexter's shitty kid to not be a serial killer because Deb is a good person. But no, Deb dies and Dexter lives forever as a deadbeat dad. Yeah. Why? You set up so many things for it to work out that Dexter gets caught by the police, by Deb, ideally.
Yes.
Right.
Right.
Yeah, I mean, I think I watched a season somewhere in there, like season 4 or something. And yeah, that seemed like the way that season should have ended and the show should have ended.
Right, right? Absolutely. Deb needed to catch Dexter, put him behind bars. This needs to be the big thing that Deb finds out. She also needs to find out, by the way, because so long throughout the show, Dexter has been like, Deb, I think this guy is the ice truck killer. Whisper, 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 and then he runs away. So Deb needed to like stand up for herself and redeem herself as a detective by catching Dex, which she doesn't. She accidentally stumbles onto Dex murdering someone and then is like, Dex, you can't keep murdering guys. He's like, Deb, I need to keep murdering guys. Okay. Right. And then they murder guys together. And then she dies.
So your alternate ending is that she catches him, he goes to jail, she raises his kids.
Yeah. That is the one that is not like everyone in the room is nodding and shrugging like, yeah, that's a good happy ending. And it's the one that is not super surprising, but it's the one that pays off the promise of this show. It's the one that delivers on what the show should be as far as story structure goes.
Yeah, they make a big deal about how she's always trying to prove herself as a detective, too, all throughout the show.
Yeah.
And doesn't really do that, right?
Right, she's living in the shadow of her father and her brother, who is so great at his job, and everyone loves Dexter, and you're just waiting for the moment that Deb is going to redeem herself and, like, really rise up to this challenge, and right. That would be her arc. But instead, her arc is bad detective, bad detective, bad detective, murderer, drug addict, dead.
Dead kid sister.
Yeah.
That's a shame.
But I think here's the insider scoop that, according to my sources, by which I mean the internet, right before the final season started, Showtime told the writers and showrunner, just by the way, you're not allowed to kill Dexter.
They did that with Homeland, too.
Yeah.
Do you watch Homeland?
Yeah, Brody's,
no.
Brody's still alive.
There's a character that is supposed to be dead.
Supposed to be dead in the first season?
Yes.
Yeah, or at least midway through the second.
Yeah.
And you know. And Showtime was like, nah, we kind of like that guy. Yeah. Don't we? Keep him around. About Dexter, the other thing that jumped out at me during the season that I was watching it was how bad he is at not getting caught. He leaves a lot of clues behind, and the cops around him should notice these clues.
Absolutely.
And so there's a theory that I liked that I guess you wouldn't as someone who doesn't like twists, but that the entire police force knew about it the whole time. They like knew he was a serial killer, and they're just like,
well, he's taking care of the other side that we can't really spend the resources on.
They're just humoring him because he was kind of valuable and made their jobs easier. So they're like, oh, who did this now?
In reality, he's not actually doing voiceover narration. That's just him, like, mumbling at the police force.
Yeah,
they'll never know that I really killed the ice truck killer.
Oh, Dexter. You're a blood splatter expert, are you? Oh, yeah. Sure you are. We need that.
Yeah.
We should comment on the fact that Dan's Dexter is...
It's my George Lucas.
Super accurate.
Yeah. Also his George Lucas.
Yeah. It's just annoying because I also like consequences in the show. Like, I'm terrible at television. I can't watch something like Californication where it's like... this freewheeling sex addict. I can't watch it for more than 3 seasons because I was like, yeah, let's get 2 seasons where he's like having sex with everybody and like there are no consequences. And then season 3, let's show what it's really like. Let's show his life breaking down, be a lesson to all the kids who shouldn't be watching this show about how sex addiction is wrong. And that's what I wanted in Dexter too, because the other promise of that show was this is what Batman would be in real life, because that's what I think they were always going for with Dexter is that...
Oh, that's interesting.
You like Batman, but in reality, Batman would be a sociopath. That what it takes to be Batman is this kind of... crazy, broken mind, and there's no reason that Batman would have the code that doesn't involve murder. Right. So Dexter is Batman. Cool. I want to see
more realistic
a more realistic
who actually
Batman.
Kills people.
Yeah, I want to see a more realistic Batman for a few seasons, and then I need a resolution of that. I need the show to prove why not only this is what Batman would be like, this is why there shouldn't be a Batman. This is why Batman is wrong. We show consequences to that. And there's no consequence if he just goes and lives in the woods where he will either keep murdering because the conceit of the show is that he's got this darkness inside him that compels him to murder or else he goes crazy. Or they break their own conceit and he lives in the woods and he's like, now that I don't have this kid, I don't feel like murdering anymore. I'm fine. I'm going to just murder some trees.
It was the kid's fault.
It was the kid's fault, yeah.
Yeah, fuck Dexter, huh?
Yeah.
Totally.
As someone who likes payoff and symmetry and vengeance, I think you said,
mm-hmm.
Did you like Breaking Bad?
I did really like Breaking Bad.
That's your ideal
People
show.
They rolled their eyes and they shrugged like, oh, he dies and he leaves money to his family. Oh, great. Who didn't see that coming? I was like, no, that's good. I like a story that is built so well that it ends the way it's supposed to end in your brain and your gut and your butts and wherever you feel things. But it still feels kind of refreshing.
Intriguingly, they had that exact ending to Dexter the episode before in Breaking Bad where he's sort of out in the woods alone. And they were like, well, that's not an ending to a show. We should
right.
do
we shouldn't
something
end a show
else.
Where a guy grows a beard and lives in the woods.
Right.
Because exactly
that would be terrible.
Dexter ended. That was another thing that was going against Dexter that I'd like to watch it again in a few years. It ended the exact same time as Breaking Bad. These are two shows about a really great actor who's playing this complicated male
what Dexter
anti-hero.
Was about?
Yeah. And both endings were telegraphed. We knew this was the final season of Dexter and the final season of Breaking Bad. They ended at the exact same time. People who are watching one are going to watch the other because it appeals to the same crowd. So you can't not hold Dexter up against Breaking Bad. Like, while step by step, for a brain like mine that needs everything neatly tied together, Breaking Bad is doing everything right. This is how you're supposed to end a show. This is how a thoughtful person ends a show. And then I switch over to Dexter and I'm like, you fucking clown shoe morons. Just delay your season a year, watch Breaking Bad, and then have a brainstorm session.
My ideal ending for Breaking Bad is ended at the end of season 4. But that's not enough consequence for you. It's like he's pure evil now. We see the plant. He's pure evil.
I think that would have been neat. That would have been a really fun
clean
show that I would have enjoyed very much. And it would have taken out the first half of season 5, which I didn't super love about Breaking Bad. But your show starts with a guy who is dying and wants to leave money for his family. That's your Chekhov's gun. Those are the things that need to pay off by midnight.
Good point. So Adam has the mind of a child, and so
totally true.
He's going to talk to us about 101 Dalmatians.
And I want to just be clear, spoiler alert, first of all. And also, I want to talk about the 1961 animated version, not the updated fixes all my problems with it, 1996 Glenn Close.
The Glenn Close one?
Yeah. Okay. It doesn't fix all of them.
My research is screwed.
All right, so 101 Dalmatians has a few story problems, particularly the way it chooses to resolve those problems is what I wanted to talk about. Specifically that after Cruella de Vil attempts to make a Dalmatian skin coat out of as many Dalmatians as she can collect, the dogs manage to rescue themselves and then go back to their owners, only not just the original 15 puppies and 2 parent dogs, but all the others just spare Dalmatians that they yeah. found at Hell Hall, as I found out, is the name of her
really?
Mansion, Hell Hall. They updated that in 96 as well.
Hell Mansion.
Yeah.
Did she name it that?
I'm not sure. It might have been passed down from generations. That was just how they titled their manor. I'm not sure. So Roger and his wife, throughout the story, they're mildly involved with the dog's plight. They refuse to sell the dogs to Cruella de Vil because they can tell she's evil. Meanwhile, Roger hates her so much that he composes a song about her, which in the off-screen time has become a hit song in 1961, enough that he is able to afford a plantation where once all the dogs, all 101 dogs, return, they decide, well, let's use the proceeds from this hit song in 1961 about Cruella de Vil and buy a plantation, and we'll just live there with all the dogs, and that'll be the ending. So a couple problems. One is it's 1961, so whatever music career he has is about to be destroyed by the Beatles and or other rock music at that era.
Yeah.
So this guy's got a money problem for sure, you know, supporting all these dogs. Also, probably 10 minutes after the ending credits, all these dogs have a lot of sex, and there's, I'm going to say, 1,000 dogs immediately thereafter.
I mean, you could neuter 100 dogs. You can neuter any amount of dogs.
And you could. I mean, but that was...
I could.
Yeah, you could personally do that, which would fix this problem. But this was the 60s, and, you know, it was free love and you know, dog plantations. Also, none of them had
seen... Why do you keep calling them plantations?
Because I think that's the term they use.
Really?
If I'm not mistaken.
Okay. I actually haven't seen this movie, I don't think.
Oh, really?
Yeah, none of this is ringing.
It's a real treasure. Also, they hadn't seen Lady and the Tramp, the people in these movies, which happened before, where a dog... Their whole self-worth goes down out the window when there's a baby, which is inevitably coming. Like, I'm sure that Roger's wife has several kids, you know?
Sure, yeah.
And then they have another caper there, probably. But all the dogs feel left out. So the point being that the ending should resolve the issues of how do we sustain this dog farm and how does Roger continue to make money in 1961 when his music career is clearly going to take a nosedive.
Yeah.
So I have a cute hokey theory about how to fix it.
Oh gosh!
The obvious.
Thank God! I thought you were just going to be like, put them all down.
Yeah, yeah.
At least 50. Yeah.
Execute the dogs. Euthanize them. No. So the one element of a Dalmatian story that's not in this movie very much is that Dalmatians are the mascots for fire departments.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
And that dates back to they are good watchdogs and befriend horses. In the 1800s, when fire carriages were carried by horses.
Everybody knows that.
Everybody knows that, right.
Sure.
But probably by the 60s, that was an outdated thing. So the one superpower that these dogs have is they are able to use the twilight bark.
Yeah.
To basically get informed about goings-on about town and also locate where the dogs are. So because they have this superpower, my theory is, why isn't there any fire people involved in this movie who... not only are dealing with the wreckage of Cruella de Vil, who has crashed her car into a van in order to chase these dogs, but also recognizes, hey, these dogs are actually good at heroics and locating things. Maybe we should continue the Dalmatian in the fire station program.
Sure.
Right?
Even if there was one fireman who was like, give me one of those dogs.
Yeah, give me, yeah, absolutely. So why don't all these dogs become the national heroes that they are already and... you know, just sort of get dispersed to various fire stations. Meanwhile, Roger, he's just running a breedery for fire stations.
For superpowered dogs.
Yeah, breeder, that's a real word.
Breedery?
Yeah, it's a breedery.
I'm not sure about that.
Let's go with it. So he, instead of, you know, writing music, because that's going to be over, he uses these dogs to continue to put out hero dogs to the local fire stations. Right, which will obviously make money because they're purebreds.
Sure.
And, you know, meanwhile, people's lives are being saved by the twilight bark, which these dogs are very capable of using. And everybody's happy. Then they can have children.
That's true. I love how convinced of yourself you are as a music producer that Roger's career is dead, that he just can't. Yeah. That the Beatles were the only ones making music.
This kid's got nothing.
Yeah, that's absolutely true. I mean, unless Roger's going to go on a, you know, a dope trip and really learn and open up to new music. What are you going to...
I really
dope
want
trip,
you in
as
this
the
movie.
Kids call it.
Yeah.
Listen, Roger, your life is fucked. You have 100 dogs. Your music career is dead. What are you doing with yourself?
Yeah. How about you open up that, you know, that dog plantation to some sales?
Yeah.
You know?
Puppy mills are less glamorous, but more reasonable way to make a buck.
I think the term is breedery.
Breedery.
Yes.
Breedery. I apologize.
It's absurd. I mean, the firefighter thing is a neat ending that pays off why we're doing Dalmatians. Like, it could have been any kind of dog in the world, but you picked Dalmatians. My story structure brain wants firefighters to be involved because
obviously.
Otherwise pick terriers, you lunatics.
Right.
But also, so their one power is starlight barking, which I'm assuming is dogs barking at twilight.
It's twilight barking.
Yeah.
But yes, it's their way of apparently like channeling all dog knowledge into like a locus of information,
but they're communicating,
I guess.
Like across town.
Yeah,
right?
Yeah.
There's a whole chain.
So their one power makes it so they don't need to be in the physically the same location.
Exactly.
And the movie ignores all the powers that they've set up for these dogs.
Right.
So since we're on this subject, I do just want to talk about something that we covered, which is a sequel. The Disney movie is based on a novel.
Yes.
And there is, in fact, a sequel to that novel written by the same author.
Uh-oh.
And it's fucking bananas. Starts with the 101 Dalmatians on their plantation, and then they wake up one morning to discover that every non-dog on Earth has fallen asleep, and the whole world is asleep. Oh, and also they can fly now?
This is
what?
You're a crazy person.
I'm not. I know it sounds like it. And the name of that novel is The Starlight Barking, which is why I said that.
Wow.
Man.
I just made all that up just to justify me saying The Starlight Barking. No, that's actually true.
No need to Google it. This is all true.
Yeah. He just kept going crazier and crazier.
Dogs can fly.
Yeah, the dogs can fly. There's something with the English prime minister. The guy basically lost his mind very publicly in his published novels about Dalmatians.
Now he's dead, probably. I'm not going to look it up.
I'm certain that's not the plot of 102 Dalmatians.
No, because there was a sequel movie, right?
Yeah.
Yeah, no, they didn't base any of it on the crazy scrawlings of this insane person.
You know the live-action movie was written and directed by John Hughes?
Really?
How crazy is that?
I did not know that.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That's just sad.
Yeah.
Sad end to that guy's career.
A little bit.
101 Dalmatians ruined a lot of lives, it sounds like.
Yeah. The saddest conversation ever about 101 Dalmatians. Jeez. Brendan.
Well, yeah. Let me lighten up the mood with The End of the World.
Yeah. With the end of the much beloved sitcom Dinosaurs.
Yeah. Where the Muppets decided to go balls to the wall and make a multicam show of giant dinosaurs with people walking inside of them. And it was a very good show for the time being as just a regular multicam sitcom until the very last episode where they decide to basically
let's just make sure people know that's not made up. This was on after or before Roseanne.
Yeah,
right
around that time.
But it was Muppets.
Yeah,
that stuff were of nightmares. Dinosaurs.
And it really closely resembled Family Matters, as I recall.
It did.
Right? Didn't
yeah,
it?
That's
super close.
Yeah.
Relatively, yeah.
I never even thought
I think
thought
the dad was
that.
A dinosaur cop, too. I'm not sure.
No, the dad worked at a
he was a tree
like
pusher.
A dinosaur, yeah. It was like the equivalent of like a factory.
Kind
of.
Yeah. I'm very apologetic.
They were a blue-collar dinosaur family.
Exactly.
Which is why I compared it to Roseanne, which is the better comparison.
Right, yeah. Jack wins the comparison.
So it was an odd choice, and I think my uncle wrote for it. I haven't seen
really?
It. Yeah.
Is that true?
Yeah.
That's crazy.
Wow.
My only other family member out here. And that's what brought them out, was writing for Dinosaurs. And it wasn't like a kid's show, right?
It was like a normal multicam sitcom.
It was like a TGIF version of a sitcom, though.
I think it was ahead of its time, honestly. It really did always feel like a meta-commentary on sitcoms.
Yeah.
Like, it was familiar. It was so Honeymooners and Roseanne, and they were doing it as dinosaurs, that it was trying to say something. I don't think it knew what its commentary was. It was just like, hey, something, sitcoms are dumb. Look, this is dumb sitcoms taken to its...
Conclusion.
Conclusion, yeah, to its extreme.
So it was like Alf, but what if everyone was Alf?
Yeah, yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
What if everyone was a crazy, cute toy creature?
Yeah. Because the jokes weren't good enough that it was like, we're trying to be a very funny sitcom.
Right.
It was trying to be about something. Like, they even had an episode where one of the characters, the son one, Spike was
Robbie?
His buddy.
Robbie,
yeah. Nice. Thank you. Nerds. He and his buddy got hooked on like the prehistoric version of drugs, and then the episode ended, he's no longer on drugs anymore. And then Robbie had his like direct to camera, we had a lot of fun here today, but drugs are a real problem.
That's
and like he's warning people about drugs that don't exist. Like, we had a lot of fun here, but
But pterodactyl eggs are no joke, kids.
Yeah.
Awesome. So how did it end, Brent?
Oh, beautifully. Just wonderfully. It was starts out with a domino effect that kills all plant life in the entire world. They're like, whoops, and have to decide to say, all right, how do we fix this? Well, what do plants need? They need water. How do you get water? Clouds. How do you get clouds? Throw bombs in volcanoes and block out the sky. That's how you get clouds for rain.
The Matrix ending? That's crazy.
That's how they ended it. The entire family in their house. Well, it's all Ice Age ushering in.
So
cold
is this,
and freezing.
They're just watching this on the news, or are they like involved in this news?
Oh, well,
story
yeah,
in
they
some way?
So this conglomerate decides to pull in Earl as the scapegoat for it, basically saying, oh, shit, we messed up pretty bad here. This Rube is going to take it for us. So he comes
Earl
in.
Earl is the dad.
Yeah, he's the father,
Carl
right?
Carl Winslow.
Exactly. And as soon as he takes over the company, that's when the Ice Age just about starts. So now he takes over the company, has to turn and to apologize to his entire family for thinking he's brought about the end of the world. And then the news thing comes on the television and says, it's just getting colder and colder. There is no end in sight. Good night and goodbye.
Yeah, it's super somber, right? They don't play it for
good night and goodbye, the last two lines of that, and it's over.
I think that is a perfect ending to amazing.
Yeah, how are we going to improve that?
I really love that. As far as story structure goes, your show is about dinosaurs. Chekhov's gun is dinosaurs are dead.
Right.
So your show needs to... I'm sorry if I spoiled that as well. The gun that needs to go off is dinosaurs die. Ice Age. Yeah.
Right. Yeah. Yeah.
What wiped them out? It was Earl the whole time. Love it.
They didn't go with the comet theory, though. Interesting.
See, that's what I was thinking. No. That would be fun if they went with the asteroid hitting the Earth, because they just roll over and die with this entire thing. They say, oh, the conglomerate's here and they've got a lot of money, so we're just fucked. That's it. And they just take it. But if they were able to give some sort of fight and really fight the conglomerate and get back to normal and then, oh, hey, what's that?
Yeah.
And then it's over at that point.
Well, that's how the dinosaurs actually died, because of this exact thing. They threw bombs into volcanoes.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
Yeah, right.
That's history.
They did their research.
So not only does every character that you've come to know in the show die a slow, agonizing death, but the main protagonist dies believing that he caused the death of everyone he's ever known.
Right after apologizing to his child and explaining to his baby that they're not going anywhere because the world is destroyed. They can't move out of the world. They don't know how to do that. And they said, well, where are we going to go, Daddy? He's like, nowhere, but we'll all stay here together. And then they just shiver, huddling together to end the show.
Does the baby at least say not the mama one more time or anything?
He just looks scared and confused.
He's scared like a baby would be trying to process death. Man, what a good show.
Yeah, Ascension Dinosaur Baby would totally do that.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So this was not a kid's show, I would say.
The last episode sure was.
That's why I feel like they must be trying to say something. They must be trying to do something about sitcoms, because otherwise they would have ended with Earl slips on a banana peel and farts super loud, and the baby's like, not the mama, or...
And hits him with a pan.
Yeah, that was the season three ending. Yeah.
Yeah, maybe they were ahead of their time.
They were doing something.
Yeah, or maybe
they were ahead of their land before time.
There
Boom,
it is.
Daddy,
there it
woo.
Is.
And he's out.
We could talk a little bit about the ending of Cheers, if you guys are familiar with Cheers. So,
Frasier. That's it. It didn't end.
Yes, right. Yeah.
That's right. Frasier was the ending of Cheers. 14-year-long ending. No, so Cheers, the large story of Cheers is essentially there was Shelley Long, who was this wacky waitress at this bar that Sam owns. And then they had a lot of problems off screen as just people. So she left the show, and there was always this like, well, they should have gotten together. They should have worked it out. So they bring her back for the last episode, and they hop on a plane, and he's going to leave his bar. So they hop on the plane, and the funny thing is they had clearly lost their chemistry as an on-screen couple, so it felt very weird. And they decide, oh, no, we shouldn't do this. So he comes back right after he was threatening to get rid of the bar, and all the people who live at that bar that the show's about were like, oh, no, now where do we have? Now what do we do? So the rest of the show is like he comes back, they're all there, and they just sort of reminisce about life. And Sam, whose whole existence as the show like is conceived, is like, well, what's my life about now? I'm a former ball player who didn't quite pan out as quite the hero I wanted to be, so now I run this bar, but what should I really do with my life? Decides, oh, you know what? I've been doing it all along. I've been running this bar. This is where I'm supposed to be. But it really makes you feel, for the first time, I think you feel like, oh, maybe this show's not about people that I want to be like.
I like
or respect.
That. I mean, that goes back to that great stuff that Daniel was talking about earlier about consequences and payoff. And like, you've got the show where it's about all these guys who hang out in the same bar every night.
Sure.
The consequences of that show, you need to show it. You need to reveal that it's not a great life. You need to reveal that, hey, people who come to the same bar and sit there every night and are so close that they know each other's personal secrets and they know all about everyone's wives, that's not good. That's not, you know,
that's not how life should be.
Right. You know that Norm has a wife, Vera.
Yeah, Vera. We only know.
Why doesn't he spend any time with her? What's going on there?
Yeah.
Like, this isn't like Norm isn't the fun guy that you want to hang out at a bar with. He's the guy who's avoiding his life. And Sam isn't like, he's never going to hop on that motorcycle and like start whatever, become a baseball coach.
For sure. And it's so interesting that the show sort of created this illusion that maybe this is a great place and you don't really think about those problems until the last episode where you do.
Yeah.
You're like, oh man, these people are all the things you just said.
Yeah, that's cool.
That's weird because Seinfeld had a similar dark ending where they acknowledged the consequences of, there's something with sitcoms acknowledging the consequences that underlie their humor.
Right.
Oh, these are all assholes.
Yeah.
And
I love that. They paraded all of those key witnesses, these familiar faces from the entire run of the show. And now you see from the other side that this group of four friends was just ruining lives for years.
Right.
I like that. I like that.
And they had that perfectly timely law, the Good Samaritan law, in whatever state that was in for 10 minutes.
Yeah.
To like have a reason to put them in jail. And then Jerry's doing stand-up in Cell Block D.
Another perfect ending for me, because you get so many years, however long that show was on the air, about these people that are like, oh, they get into these wacky circumstances. No, people have died and you've ruined lives and you've made a whole lot of people very miserable.
Yeah.
And you know what? You're in jail and you're still doing your same bullshit, like they're talking about breakfast.
Right,
and in jail and like doing bits and stuff with each other. Good. That's what you all deserve. You deserve to rot in
be with each other forever. Yeah. They actually went back and did the same comment about Jerry's buttons not being great, which was, I think, the first ever joke on the first episode of the show, implying this is cyclical.
I can't decide if that's just the writers being up their own ass or the repeating the first joke as the last joke that's annoying to me.
Yeah.
They needed to do something. They couldn't just do business as usual, right? Like, what is the other ending for Seinfeld? The other one that makes sense is just another fucking episode of Seinfeld where Jerry is dating someone and George is scheming and Kramer is doing some Kramer thing and Elaine is also around. They go to Monk's Diner again and they hang out there, and it's not going to be like Friends where
they all marry off.
People marry off and some people, well, I'm Joey, I'm going to go to LA now and try to start my own acting career out there. Jerry's not going to like, you know what, I was going to be a senator. And he goes, you know, no one's going to have a mega happy ending for that show. They're not going to have anything big.
It's just interesting that sitcoms were allowed to have these crazy, appropriately dark endings while Showtime can't end a show about a serial killer with that serial killer dying.
Yeah, it's sort of like they inverse paths, right?
I think Friends, there was like this lawsuit where someone sued the writers of Friends because they were so filthy in the writer's room.
Yeah.
And this one running joke they had was that Joey was a serial rapist the whole time. And like that all his behavior could be explained by him being like secretly a serial rapist. I think that's the ending we would have had to Friends if the writers were allowed to do what they wanted.
That's where the Joey spinoff was clearly headed.
Right. Yeah. Yo, Ski Woski, P Ski Weeski, what you wanna do, Ski? Nate Daniel, niggas get jacked like Daniel. Something I can't handle. Yo, okay. Yo, this is my story, this is my song. And to them rooted poops, don't attempt to drop this at home, it's just a poem. And to y'all, learn right from wrong. Know when to bless a situation, when to grab the throne. But it's back on. All right, that was our conversation about weird, dark endings of sitcoms and weirdly happy or whitewashed endings of shows about serial killers. So I wanted to circle back one more time and talk about Twilight, because I just cannot drop this. So here's how Stephanie Meyer describes her process for writing Twilight before she wrote the fourth book. This is like on her website, I guess. And she's writing this in between the third and fourth, when there's like all this pressure for her to end the saga in some way that's really satisfying. And she starts out saying, I didn't set out to write a novel or begin a career as an author. I was just writing down a story for my personal enjoyment, letting it grow as it would and lead where it would. No pressure, just fun. And then she goes on for like five paragraphs defending herself against accusations that her characters aren't feminist enough and speculating about books that she'll write from Edward's perspective after the fourth book finishes the franchise. She can't wait to get this fourth book over with. And so I think it's just an interesting insight into the mind of one of our finest authors, clearly, but just the sort of different mindset of someone going into writing the first thing just in a dark room somewhere without an audience, without any judgment being passed on it, which is how pretty much every ending by internet fan forums is generated. You're just trying to impress your friends or make them laugh. And then when you're a national celebrity ending a wildly successful saga, suddenly you're weighing things like whether Bella is a feminist or not. She's not, but Stephanie Meyer wanted to believe that she was. All right, I think I have all the Twilight out of my system. I'm going to stop talking about Twilight now for at least a few minutes. Also, real quick, we just published a book called The D-Text Book, and it is a fully illustrated, full-color textbook that goes through your education and systematically destroys the myths you learned and replaces them with truth that is even more interesting than the bullshit that they made up and put there in the first place. It's really good. It's really handsome book, you know, well-designed, looks like a textbook. Go buy it at Amazon or Barnes & Noble or wherever people buy books these days. All right, footnotes. Before we get to the music, the Twilight fan theory was first brought to my attention in the article Five Fan Theories That Are Better Than the Movie by C. Coville, Kevin Bell, and J.F. Sargent. It's a great article. I don't know why I made up such a crappy-sounding title in the interview. Great work, guys. Go read that. Okay, this episode and next week's episode will be my Great Endings playlist, either great last songs on classic albums or one-off songs that take an awesome turn at the end, sort of the House of Balloon, Glass Party Girls, honorary strong closers, if you will. First up, you heard Wu-Tang : 7th Chamber Part 2 by a rap collective out of the Staten Island borough of New York that goes by the name of Wu-Tang Clan. Now, I think I've talked a lot on this podcast about how hard I rode for these guys as a teenager in Kentucky, having every Wu-Tang album cover on my wall. The verses of this album are still echoing around in my head when I wake up in the morning, and it is the 20th birthday of Enter the 36 Chambers, the name of the first Wu-Tang album. And 7th Chamber Part 2 is the last song on that first album, and the one track that has just never gotten old for me. So, happy 20th birthday, the Wu-Tang Clan, you bunch of fucking weirdos. Speaking of weird dudes, 2 Chainz. So, he has this song with Fergie that's just pretty straightforward what you'd expect from a song by 2 Chainz and Fergie about making a sex tape and putting it on Netflix, which I don't think is possible. That's the part you heard before the break, but then, halfway through, it just turns aggressively awesome out of nowhere, and 2 Chainz starts just shouting nonsense about various physically impossible sexual maneuvers, and then, with about 40 seconds to go, this happens. Bitch, I dropped the label. Goddamn. Yeah, I don't know. I love that part. It just gets so weird there at the end. I don't think I've ever pulled such a complete 180 on a song in the last 30 seconds. And finally, back to great final tracks on classic albums. Chonky Fire by Outkast. Last track on Aquemini, which just owned my entire senior year of high school. And again, like 7th Chamber Part 2, it was never my favorite song as a kid, but it just like keeps bubbling up in my head, and every time I go back to it, I like it a little better. I think Spotty-Oddy Dopalicious off of that album is probably still the best song on the album, or the one that holds up the best, but Chonky Fire is a close second for me. Go buy it. Yeah, we'll ride out on a Big Boy's delirious piano solo verse. Next week, I sit down with a new team of crack writers and restore the correct endings to some classic movies. We Kaiser Soze the hell out of Forrest Gump and Son of a Woman. Didn't know Kaiser Soze was a verb, did you? I will talk to you guys then. To make one bob the head be the track job, your job to spit that fire. Some of y'all MC take this rhyming for granted. I won't comply with that slacking. Popping and cracking, 4-4 say we snapping. They want that hardness, that oddness that gets a nigga to start this. What's happening? See if I do what you won't do today, boy. Will I live tomorrow like you can't even live? Cause you straight, motivational skills lacking. When I see a nigga, you're packing. Understand that though, you behind a $75,000 condo. But still stay with mom though, playing the king like Dondo. You choked up, you was a nigga that's supposed to been so low up. Making them think hip hop is dead. Exhume the body if you ain't scared. If I see you in the streets, I dap you down like you were bread. Yeah, we reign, supreme, bream, dungeon, kings. Do you know what brings rats, mice, snakes about they home, chalking
by? This has been an Earwolf Media production. Executive producers Jeff Ulrich and Scott Aukerman. For more information, visit earwolf.com.
Earwolf Radio Boom.com. Oh, oh, oh. The wolf dead.